one thing that, I guess, wasn't mentioned about, about Trump's promise for a wall, you know, he was forced to abandon his campaign promise to get the Mexicans to pay for it. I just spent 5 months in Mexico and, you know, talking to at least educated people in Mexico. I can tell you that the Mexicans would be quite happy to pay for the wall if it were built on the U.S.-Mexico border as it was in 1846, which was, you know, where in California and most of the southwestern states were part of Mexico before the U.S. invaded and annexed half of Mexico. My story on Canada is basically going to be that the Canadian model of immigration, which is based on a high level of skilled migration, which remains popular, that is still intact through the last, I wrote the chapter in the second edition, third edition, it's still there in the fourth, in my paper on the fourth edition. The different political parties, succession of governments in Canada, have emphasized the differences that they have one with the other. But in a comparative context, I think it's the similarities that are most evident. And I think, you know, the main issue that I want to emphasize is that the current Liberal government of Justin Trudeau has promised to jack up immigration to even higher levels, as much as 50% higher than they are today. And it hasn't happened yet. And the real question is, will they actually do that? And will the political support for immigration remain? So I'm going to review a number of specific issues about immigration policy that have come up, which I think will illustrate the point I'm making about the sustained popularity of the Canadian immigration program. Of course, the populism that exists in many other countries that will be described as already for the U.S. and for other countries, which I don't want to review, is exists in Canada, but with one difference, which is does not include the anti-immigrant component, which some have seen to be essential to populism. In Canada, we had, during 5 to 10 years ago, a mayor in Toronto who was a laughingstock of North America, but he was actually the forerunner of the populace. He was a rich kid who inherited his father's business. He was a self-styled, this is Rob Ford, the self-styled supporter of the little guy. He campaigned against the so-called cultural elites. He was a full-scale misogynist, a braggart and a liar, and conducted a war on the media. He just wasn't anti-immigrant. In fact, his famous cocaine habit was supplied by his connections with the immigrant community. His brother, who is now the Premier of Ontario and implementing some of his policies, his personally doesn't not as popular and personally appealing as the guy I just described, he is also staying away from the immigration story. Canadian model, as I mentioned, based on high numbers, points selected immigrants based on their employability or human capital, increasing diversity of the population, involves public and all-party support for immigration. We have also support, continuing support for multiculturalism, which people now think is part of the Canadian identity. We have settlement programs, which spend a fair amount of public money on assisting immigrants, including language training. And there's been a lot of stability in this program over time. Let me just quickly review some of the numbers here. For the last 20 years or so, the numbers of immigrants in Canada have been around 300,000, close to 1% of population. And relative to population size, that's, you know, you can do the numbers. It's about double or triple the rate of immigration into the United States on a per capita basis, even if you include the illegal or undocumented immigrants. Most of the immigrants are coming in the economic category, or the points selected folks and their families. A fair number of family class immigrants, but they're relatively the minority. That's the green category. And the refugees in the red category are a small percentage, and although they are often publicly discussed, they're lumped in with immigrants in general and remain popular. The Liberal government has emphasized the reception of refugees. You can see the larger red line there in the last figure for 2016 on the right, which is the first year of the Trudeau government. There's been a shift in the origins of immigrants. This chart shows the origins of immigrants to Canada on a percentage distribution across different origins. From before 1981 to the most recent five-year period. The gray bar at the top are the Europeans, and the blue is the United States, and so you can see that shrinking to a relatively small proportion over time. In the context of global migration, of course, North American migration is a small component. As a result of the immigration, Canada has a fairly high proportion of foreign-born population, second only to Australia in this group. And the major cities of Canada have high proportions of immigrants. Toronto, over 45%, and Vancouver also relatively high compared to the major immigration cities in the United States. And Calgary, Winnipeg, Edmonton, and Montreal also rank highly relative to other North American cities. I want to emphasize the impact of immigration on the city of Toronto and how it's changed over time. In 1971, the proportion of the population of the city of Toronto, which was of non-European origin, was 5%. And by the way, that's the year in which, remember, that the multiculturalism policy was first announced. It was announced in the context in which the diversity that was being discussed was European diversity, the Italians, the Polish, the Ukrainians, and so on. What's happened since then is, as a result of mass immigration, mostly by folks of non-European origin, is that non-European component has grown to the point where in 2016, they're actually a majority of the population of Toronto. And you can see that the city itself has grown from 2 million to close to 6 million. So what's in effect happened in the last 45 years is that the population, an additional city of 3 million people, the size larger than the size of the city initially, has been added to the population. It is now a majority-minority city. So, and yet, the immigration remains popular. So that's a remarkable feature. Here's a public opinion poll over time showing that the proportion who disagree that immigration is too high has actually grown during the period when immigration was increasing relative to those who think that it is, who agree that it is too high. If you look at the Gallup poll question, which is, you know, the question I just showed you was, do you agree that immigration is too high? So that has the positive response bias. People are maybe more likely to say that it is to agree that it's too high. This question was a more equal, a more neutral question. If it was your job to formulate immigration policy, would you leave the numbers where they are? Would you increase or decrease? The proportion who say that's okay the way it is, or you should increase, has been the majority in every year since 1975, with one exception, 1983 there, or 82, which was a recession year. But the support has actually grown in the more recent period. The Gallup stopped doing those polls, but others are doing it, like, for example, ECOS research. And again, their results show majority support for keeping immigration as it is or increasing it. The Pew study cross-nationally that was just released this spring shows that on questions about favoring immigration. That's a good thing for the country or not. Canada has led the PAC on in support for immigration, and they also looked at polarization over immigration between left and right, and the data showed less polarization in Canada between left and right on the issue. This is another chart from the Marshall Fund study in 2010, which showed Canadians supporting immigration. A lot of debate has occurred over why Canadians support immigration, and we have maybe Will Kimlick dominated the discussion a lot by saying, actually, you know what it is? It's multiculturalism. Canadians are multicultural, or liberal attitudes, and the multiculturalism program is working, so immigrants are being integrated more effectively. Since the 9/11 and the terrorist concerns, he's been forced to abandon this position. It's empirically incorrect anyway, but he's been compiling data on on multicultural policies in a number of countries, and has concluded that it's too early to decide whether multiculturalism is really having an impact. He also showed, by the way, that if you draw that conclusion based on evaluating policies in different countries that don't actually use the word multiculturalism, and found that when you do that, actually multicultural policies have been advancing in the world. We're not retreating from multiculturalism, as people say. We're retreating from the word multiculturalism, which is unpopular politically. He even found that when you compare Canada and the US during the 80s, both countries had equally multicultural policies. I want to go to this, some data on this that supports this position. If you ask the members of the population in a variety of countries about multicultural issues, you find that there are some surprising results. On this chart, we have survey data from different countries on two components of multicultural attitudes. One, the population belief in the potential for foreigners to be full members of national societies. And you can see on that dimension, Canada, the United States, and Australia rank highly. These are the traditional countries of immigration. They have that as part of their national identity. You're a foreigner, you can become a full member of the national community. On the horizontal dimension is the question of valuing diversity. Do you think that immigrants should retain their culture or blend into the mainstream society? So on the right, you have the more multicultural version. You can see nobody's up in the multicultural quadrant of this particular, the upper right-hand corner. But Canada and the US are quite similar, actually not that different. And if you separate Quebec from the rest of Canada, you can see that Quebec is sort of dragging Canada away from the multicultural part of it. Quebec is actually more assimilationist than France in these data. And for reasons that we could go into. I've been currently doing research comparing the integration of Muslims in France, Quebec, and English Canada. Very interesting topic. And basically shows that these national models, which are varying there, actually have some impact on the integration process, but maybe less than you might imagine. I put forward that the Canadian popularity of immigration is partly due to our differences of geography and history. We don't have a border with Mexico. We're not a colonial power with a legacy of obligations to former colonial populations. And as a result, Canada is able to control immigration to an extraordinary degree. And as the Economist magazine pointed out, I think quite rightly, it's easier to be relaxed about immigration when your only land border is protected by a wall the size of the United States. And I would just add to that that Canadians actually got the Americans to pay for that wall, which puts them ahead of Trump in dealing with Mexico. The New York Times also pointed out, I think importantly, that even if you have control over migration, doesn't mean necessarily that you're going to do a good job. And I think the Canadians should maybe be credited for taking advantage of the opportunity created by their capacity to control. I mean, the New York Times calls it Canada's ruthlessly smart immigration policy. And I have to point out to my Canadian friends that in New York, to be called ruthless is a compliment. Trump is supposedly adopting a Canadian merit-based system for the United States. Actually, that's a misnomer, because he's assuming that the border wall with Mexico will work, first of all. But secondly, the real point of his policy innovation is to reduce family class immigration to zero. And he wants to then allow only those folks who are relatively uneducated, who are, have become American citizens due to the amnesty of the 1986, to they can bring in members of their family only if they're highly educated. But the Canadian policy of high-skilled, point-selected immigrants is to bring in very large numbers of immigrants at the high-skill level. And that's something the United States doesn't really want to do. I mean, the United States already has a high-skilled immigration stream. It's just small. And I think one of the things we're going to find out in the Canadian case, when we've tried to improve immigration, improve the employability of immigrants by getting employers involved in immigrant selection, is that actually employers don't want very many high-skilled immigrants. They want, there's a few that want that. But they, if we want high-skilled immigrants, we have to let them in the country and let them find the jobs for themselves. That's the point of the point system. So just a couple of, I realize that we're late. I don't want to stand between people and their lunch. So let me just, I wanted to summarize these various policy areas. One point, central point, is that despite the increasing educational levels of immigrants, they have been struggling more and more in the labor market. And these data, this is sort of an iconic chart that showed how immigrants in the aggregate were having more and more difficulty earning less and less in relation to the mainstream Canadian workforce, despite the fact that the qualifications were being jacked up. So, and there's various reasons that have been put forward for that. I think one important, the economists have mentioned that immigrants have had less and less value for their foreign experience. I find that statistically that seems to work, but it doesn't explain it in terms of economic trends. I think that the shift to the knowledge economy is very important, which means that employers are more and more are concerned with credentials. They don't know what the foreign credentials mean. Also, labor market inequalities have been increasing in Canada, and immigrants who are working at the bottom end of the income distribution will be affected more by that than other groups. This is showing the relative patterns of inequality in Canada and the U.S., and you can see the U.S. is increasing more, but it's definitely increasing in Canada. And recent immigrants are much more frequently working at minimum wage and are affected by what is the minimum wage. So, but this trend, this downward trend, is has been dealt with by the conservative government of Stephen Harper, no longer in power, mainly by attempting to get immigrants into jobs before they arrive. Well, they've revised the points grid to emphasize more labor market characteristics. They now test language knowledge of applicants, whereas they used to simply accept their own self-appraisal. They've increased their emphasis on occupations in demand in the workforce. They've shifted the point selector away from work experience, which wasn't counting for much, to being young. They require that their credentials be assessed in terms of equivalence to Canadian before they actually are approved for visas in Canada. a number of innovations that have attempted to get employers involved in immigrant selection more than they have been in a number of ways. One is the temporary foreign worker program, immigrants where employers apply to have temporary workers come into the country. It's possible for those folks at certain skill levels to transition to permanent status. Another opportunity for employers to be involved in selection is the provincial nomination program. The provinces may nominate people for visas to Canada, increasingly as a result of agreements with the federal government, and that has increased the role of employers. I think that that is a potential problem because of the fact that employers as private citizens are concerned only with their own fairly immediate self-interest and not necessarily with the long-term interests of the country. And there's the problems of fraud and so on, all those folks that, you know, all those issues that have been encountered in the United States and in other countries. I want to just emphasize the new program, administrative innovation called Express Entry, which was supposedly borrowed from the Australians. The Canadian government under Harper had decided actually that the most successful immigration program in the world was not the Canadian one, but the Australian one. And so one of the features that they were taking on was the expression of interest pool, which basically meant that people did not apply for immigration to Canada. You simply fill out a profile form, which allowed you to be considered. And then you could be invited to apply if you met various considerations. And employers could look at that profile list and identify someone that they wanted to bring into the country, and they would be then given priority. This had the virtue of eliminating the backlog of applicants. The previous system had a huge backlog because we offered people the opportunity to apply for immigration to Canada, and there were fixed selection criteria, so it was simply a question of waiting in line until your number came up. And the difficulty was that the line grew to 600,000-700,000, and it took 10 years to get into the country. So this system basically eliminated that, because every year, if you're not selected, you have to reapply the next year. And some didn't like this system, but I had to say, well, you know, this is a system we use in the universities. You know, people apply, they don't get in, they have to apply next year. So how can we object to that for the country? And eventually the backlog was eliminated. What's been interesting, though, about this system, and they have not only the original point system, which people had to survive that selection process in order to even fill out the profile online. But then they were subjected to a second point system called the Comprehensive Rating Scheme. And you could get up to 1,200 points. And 600 of those would be based on various specific Canadian connections, having a Canadian degree, or especially having a valid job offer. And what's happened is that the valid job offers were increasingly at lower and lower skill levels, indicating that employers, they don't, if you want to hire a top-end economist, the University of Toronto does not go to the immigration list to see which top-end economist has applied to come to Canada, because they're not there, right? So you can't fill the top-end jobs that way. And as a result, they've basically abandoned in a very quiet way, without publicly stating this, the emphasis on job offers. But you can see the impact that these changes have had on the skill levels of immigrants. This chart shows the proportion of immigrants in different entry categories that have bachelor's degrees. And in 1994, the principal applicant, the one who is in the economic stream, the one who's evaluated based on points, 40% had a bachelor's degree. In 2005, that had gone up to 80%. They doubled that as a result of attempting to get in more highly skilled people who would get into the labor market more quickly. Since then, these various innovations that I mentioned to get employers involved have actually brought that number down to 55%. So that's a very substantial reduction. By the way, 2012 is the last year in which they published these figures. They're not showing this anymore. Instead, they show the skill level in their annual reports, the skill level of immigrants' intended occupation, which they have only for half the immigrants anyway. So the data had been sort of shrouded in a bit of mystery there. We don't really know what's happening. I'm not sure how much more time I have here. I want to mention that the previous government also got into a bit of hot water with the temporary immigration program. They jacked up the immigrants to a relatively high number and of temporary immigrants, and there were supposed to be people coming in for jobs that the Canadians weren't taking. Initially, they brought them in. You could pay those folks up to 15% below what the Canadian standard, you know, so how is that not going to affect the Canadian labor market? It's hard to see. But there were various scandalous stories that appeared in the media about how immigrants were being brought in to fill jobs where Canadians already had those jobs, and they were laid off and put the immigrants in there. And so that caused the government to cut the temporary foreign worker program way back, supposedly. But these new liberal ministers of immigration were supposedly studying this and are going to make sure that these kind of scandals never happened again. But if you look at the actual numbers of temporary workers coming into the country, the so-called temporary foreign worker program, actually the numbers leveled off. They never went down at around 200,000. But there's another category that's been published since then, and the previous data reconstructed, called the International Mobility Program. Nobody knows what that is. That has subcategories called Canadian interests and another category called competitiveness, and you know, things that sound good, but no one, you can't see what's in it. And the numbers have gone up to over 500,000 who are in the country with legal status in the country, over 500,000. So it's expanded. And it's again, another example of the Liberal government saying that they're going to address problems with the previous government's policies, but appearing to simply let in more temporary workers without a labor market assessment at all. That's the feature, by the way, I should mention, of the International Mobility Program, was that a labor market assessment was not necessary for those folks. The skill distribution, some of them are at the high levels, but many of them are at the intermediate or low skill levels. These data only go up to 2009. The Auditor General, who had written let me see. I'll forget that. This just supports the point. I will mention that attitudes are not different. We have racists in Canada, and the studies of racial discrimination in the labor market show important effects. This is a study, a widely publicized study, where resumes were sent by an economist to employers in Toronto and Montreal, and with the difference being only that an Asian name was on some and not on others. And you can see that 30% disadvantage for Asian-named resumes in getting a callback for an interview, even if they have Canadian education and Canadian work experience. If they didn't have that, well, you know, they're going completely at a lower level. So there's a lot of discrimination. It seems to be similar in Toronto and Montreal. A lot of interest, especially in English in Canada, in the new legislation or the policies proposed in Quebec to address the issue of religious accommodation and secularism. And so although the Quebec Charter of Values, which was going to make it difficult for people to get public services if they were wearing a headscarf or some religious symbol like that, that was never implemented because the government that proposed it was thrown out of office, and a lot of people thought, well, okay, we're in the clear on that issue. But now we have a Coalition Avenir Quebec government, which has, as of June 17th, just early a few days ago, passed a law banning the wear of religious symbols by public servants, including judges, police officers, and including school teachers. So this is only the government employees, not the members of the public, not the school children, as in France, but there is a law on this, and it is controversial. But again, our data show that the integration of Muslim immigrants in Quebec is actually as good as it is in English Canada.
Your time has elapsed.
Yeah. So that concludes what I want to say. I just will say that the national models issue of in Canada, which has emphasized multiculturalism, I think is showing... showing that it has relatively little impact and that our real advantage over other countries is geographic and historic.